Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the next hour. Every Monday morning, the Moles bring our listeners a variety of views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonialist perspective. We're now well into the holiday season and wondering what changes are coming in the next several months and whether they will be enough to save us from the multiple crises of economic decline, racism, the pandemic, and climate change. Today, we focus on climate, labor relations, race, and history. Sharon Grant will bring us a piece about the 1918-19 flu pandemic, World War I, and the racial conflict precipitated by those two events. Larry Bolden will be reviewing a book set in both East and West Germany before the fall of the wall, and I will be talking to a resident physician at OHSU about their new union and collective bargaining process. To start our show, Bill Resnick talks to Carla Frisch, who worked for 10 years in the U.S. Department of Energy before going to the Rocky Mountain Institute to help cities develop and implement quite radical climate action plans. They discuss the Biden-Harris plan, if in some items being deferent to some impacted industries, is the most sweeping action plan to ever be offered by a national politician, much less a political party. Of course, it will be strongly opposed and meaningfully implemented only after great public pressure.
Hi, Carla Frisch. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Carla Frisch does policy work, planning, some implementation, helping cities. She's a city change maven, actually, helping cities transform to zero greenhouse gas emission pollution. She works at the Rocky Mountain Institute on their program. It's called America's Pledge, working to ensure that this country remains a global leader in reducing those emissions. That's quote from them. Before that, for 10 years, she worked at the U.S. Department of Energy with similar responsibilities. Carla Frisch, first give us your analysis of the Biden plan. It was partly a Kerry-Sanders negotiation, Biden plan. Then we can get to what Biden must do to stop global roasting and how the Biden administration will have to be very strongly encouraged to do that. There's a lot of people who don't want to change much in this country. They have to be very strongly encouraged by, among other things, great marches and actions. Carla Frisch, first your assessment of the Biden plan.
Right. Great question. So there's the Biden-Harris climate plan that was released as part of the campaign. And then, as you mentioned, there was a task force put together with leaders from all walks of life, including Senator Sanders, that also laid out what needs to happen on climate in the U.S. And I will say on the Biden-Harris climate plan, it is the boldest plan we've ever seen from a presidential candidate or a president-elect. Climate featured more in the election conversations this year than ever before. And if you look into the details of the plan, what you see is a mirror of what the science and analysis about limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius also said. So limiting warming, avoiding the worst impacts of climate change, and really building a sustainable economy for the U.S. require moving towards clean electricity, using that clean electricity efficiently, of course, in our buildings, in our transportation, and in our industry, and also really optimizing the way that we manage our lands to help sequester CO2 in our farms and our forests and our wetlands. And that plan, the Biden climate plan, mirrors what the science and analysis shows us is needed in those areas.
Some of the details I found very interesting. There is a few lines, and of course it's very complex. There's so many things that have to be done, and it's a bit of a kitchen sink approach, but it does include many directions, I think, that lots of industries are not going to be happy about, like fuel economy standards, much more building electric vehicles very quickly. Some of the changes in agriculture would be a challenge for agribusiness. He also, though, emphasizes, it seems to me, very important, granted really is politically important, the creation of really good American jobs. In the plan, there are some really controversial things, it seems to me, for many of his supporters. It does not eliminate nuclear power. It was very clear on the campaign trail that there'll be no bans on fracking. I think he did that somewhat. He had to win Pennsylvania, which is a big, big fracking state in rural areas. And there's monies for clean coal. I mean, that's necessary to keep Joe Mancini happy on the Democratic side. There are lots of compromises in there. You know, there's also no production standards for electric vehicles. They could last for 50 years. They'll make them to last for maybe 15 years. And then you get a whole new cycle of pollution from having to build all of those things and refine the metals and everything. He doesn't go out on a limb on those issues that would really bring opposition from industry.
Well, I think what you're pointing out is addressing climate in the U.S. and building a sustainable economy is really a whole of the economy and a whole of society effort that touches all different parts of our lives. And I think that the Biden-Harris plan is bold in many areas. Of course, as you're saying, you know, no one's going to be happy with all elements of any plan. But I think it really moves us more in the direction that we need to be. And an important element that you were talking about was on clean jobs and industry. So we know that renewable energy creates more jobs per $1 million of investment than fossil fuels. And it's really a growing area of the economy, and solar and wind and electric vehicles. And the other important element of the plan that I think is newer on the national stage is the explicit focus on equity and environmental justice, and really looking at the intersection between addressing climate change, addressing pollution, air pollution, water pollution, criteria air pollutants, systemic racial injustice, and systemic economic injustice, and really starting to understand how all of those issues are linked, and how clean energy can help support progress in lots of different issue areas. And of course, reducing the greenhouse gas emissions, reducing criteria air pollutants, and improving both indoor and outdoor air quality, and building sustainable jobs, and really creating the path forward for a sustainable economy for the U.S.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Carla Frisch, who works at the Rocky Mountain Institute. We've been talking about the Biden-Harris plan, climate change plan, that for me, it owes a lot to the discussion between Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders with John Kerry, the new envoy, Biden's envoy to the world. We didn't talk about that. It's very important, though, that the U.S. is going to try and corral China and various other countries to actually implement their plans and go way beyond it. It's not inconceivable if the U.S. offers some financial help. In any event, Carla, let's talk about what your expertise is in transforming cities. You've been writing about greening the cities and how important that is, and also local resilience and local supplying of energy. Why don't you get into those issues? Why it's so important to transform cities, reconstruct them?
So when we talk about cities, you can think of that as a broad term that covers cities, municipalities, local governments, counties. So basically at that smaller scale, or, you know, sometimes cities are quite large, but cities themselves have quite a bit of authority. So one example is on building codes. You know, of course, those are distributed at the local level because of the different climate zones. And so local governments can help set building codes in ways that are right for their area and also help optimize efficiency and really reduce energy loss and tighten up the housing and commercial building stock to make it more comfortable for residents. But there's lots of areas that cities are making huge progress on and have the opportunity to grow their infrastructure and build more sustainable economies. So actually, my colleagues have recently put out a paper on this where they look at the opportunities for mobility and accelerating vehicle electrification, and importantly, making sure that the space in cities really works for people to get around and offers all kinds of mobility alternatives. On power, you know, lots of cities are doing direct procurement of clean, renewable electricity. They're finding that that lowers costs. And there's lots of different and creative ways that they're using to buy that power. And then on broadband, on water, on natural systems, huge opportunities here to build green space into cities, both to get the air quality benefits, but really for the health and enjoyment of the residents of those cities.
Yeah, I've done interviews with people in Lancaster, California, up in the high desert east of LA, northeast. They've really electrified the whole city, and they've also bought a wind turbine farm out in the desert, like 20 miles away. And they're putting money into electric buses. That is an energy agency, the public agency that took over energy supply. And they're also contributing to building a big light rail line into the jobs that people work at in L.A. and eastern L.A. It seems to me that's a model for what cities can do. They really get very, very cheap energy from their wind plantation, but also because nearly every house in that city has solar panels now. And they contribute a very large amount of energy, and they also create this culture of energy conservation and use reduction in the city. Is that a possible model for cities across the country so that we don't have to spend trillions and trillions of dollars on the big continent-spanning grids from nuclear power plants and also coal plants still and the rest of them? Carla, that's my question.
Well, Bill, your key word there is electricity. And there's a huge opportunity for cities, for local governments on clean electricity. One, solar and wind power are cheaper than they've ever been before. In some cases, cheaper to build new than operate existing coal or gas fossil power plants. And as our electricity keeps getting cleaner and cleaner, when we use it in our buildings, in our vehicles, then they're getting cleaner and cleaner. So you mentioned on buildings. The opportunity here is instead of combusting gas, and we don't always combust it fully in our homes for HVAC or hot water, we can use clean electricity for our appliances and our HVAC and both help reduce our greenhouse gas impact, but also significantly improve our indoor air quality. Because often the NOx emissions from a gas stove can be higher than outdoor ambient air quality standards. And on the transportation front, it's the same thing with electric vehicles. As electricity gets cleaner and cleaner, it's already at the point where driving an electric vehicle is cleaner than driving a gas-powered vehicle. So we can start to make that shift to electric transportation. And then if you think about, you know, walking the streets of a city and breathing the air, or standing at a bus stop, the more electric vehicles you have on the road, that really helps with the air quality, particularly in cities. So it's a huge opportunity.
And, you know, one thing I liked about one of the reports from you that I read, greening the city, having just a greater tree canopy, doing urban agriculture, those things greatly reduce the heat island effect in cities, therefore using much less energy for air conditioning. And it also makes for a beautiful city and a city that's more walkable and bikeable for alternative transport. And it makes people proud of their city and recognizing the importance of that reconstruction. I gather
that's right, Bill. And I think that green space has been particularly important, as we're all dealing with COVID, too, in dense urban areas where folks have been trying to stay indoors and trying to stay isolated, having access to a park, you know, a bit of nature to be able to get outside, and not only helps the city look beautiful and reduce emissions, but really provides that bit of respite and health for residents. And Bill, one thing I wanted to pick up on that you were talking about is the role of cities in helping push the national conversation. What we've seen the last 4 years is we had a federal government that was not focused on climate. That could be a bit of an understatement. And cities, along with counties, tribes, states, businesses and investors, artists, cultural institutions like museums, universities, and colleges, they took a real leadership role and stood up and said, we are continuing to move forward on climate, and we have control over our own campuses, our own location on the things that we can do to help move toward a clean energy future. But we can also help influence our peers, help influence the rest of the U.S., and help influence on a national stage. And if you look at the coalitions of cities, states, and businesses, and other leaders in the U.S. that have committed to climate action, it's almost 70% of U.S. GDP. Almost 70% of U.S. GDP. That is globally significant. It's bigger than any country GDP except the U.S. itself.
Yeah, and I have to say, I sort of like that slogan, save the cities, save the planet. After all, it's the cities that are driving the extractionism in all of our urban areas, the mining, the coal, the extraction of oil, the transport of oil, the refining of oil, all of that is to serve the cities. If the cities, in fact, go electric, the coal companies would go under very, very, very rapidly. It's the cities that sort of drive so much consumption. And if we can reconstruct the cities, it's a great thing. Carla Frisch, you've been really helpful in talking about this. It seems to me one final part of the solution is political. The Biden-Harris plan is actually a huge advance in many ways. It makes some compromises. It seems to me it's disappointing in a few ways, but you don't get everything, and calculations of acceptability. In any event, it seems to me that there's going to be a lot of push from people who really don't want to change, or who say, well, the other industries have to change, but our industry, oh no, we're somehow going green on our own, whatever they're going to say. Or that we're going to do geoengineering and new technology like clean coal. They have their own plan, and they're going to really resist the idea of reconstructing the economy. It does seem to me that there has to be a political push from the grassroots, and unions are also important in building that culture of creating clean energy. What's your sense of it? I see the need for some great marches and actions, and even the kinds of civil disobedience that the Sunrise Movement and Extinction Rebellion do, calling for especially young people. Our lives depend on it. Our children's lives depend on it. How do you see that? It seems to me that political action would probably be necessary to push a meaningful agenda.
Right. And what you're pointing out there, Bill, is that solutions to climate really require an all of society approach. And I think a great example of success has been the movement towards 100% clean energy. So just going back a couple years, in 2017, Hawaii was the only state committed to and put into law that they were going to move to 100% clean energy. And at that time, I think there was more than 30 cities who had made that commitment. And just fast forward from 2017 to 2020, now 13 states and Puerto Rico have committed to 100% clean. More than 170 cities have committed to 100% clean. And more than 30 have actually already achieved it. And Sierra Club tracks this, so you can see the new commitments online. But what's amazing to me about that is it starts with one conversation with people at a city council or citizens talking to their state government about wanting to move in this direction. And the movement has just grown. We've seen the commitments. We've seen the follow through on meeting the commitments. And now 100% clean energy by 2035 is a key tenet of the Biden-Harris platform. We've got conversations all over Capitol Hill on what a clean electricity standard, what a clean energy standard might look like. And it's a really live national policy conversation that's moving much more quickly than I would have anticipated in 2017. So that quick shift is really built on the foundation of Americans who support this transition. And if you look at the polling, 79% of Americans want to move towards clean energy. 79%, that's a huge part of America. And taking action in their own communities helps continue to build this momentum that we're now seeing play out on the national and international stage. It's really amazing.
Kyla Frisch of the Rocky Mountain Institute, I really appreciate your work and your optimism. In fact, your warranted optimism. There really have been enormous changes in the last 5 or 10 years across this country in terms of public attitudes and, in fact, in terms of clean energy, different kinds of alternative transport, building standards, in fact, even conservation and use reduction and questioning of the real high consumption way of life in this country. It can't be replicated across the world, that's for sure. Kyla Frisch of the Rocky Mountain Institute, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. And I think you're right. We've made a lot of progress, and together we have a good ways to go, but we're on the path to get there.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
That was Bill Resnick and Kyla Frisch talking about the Biden-Harris climate plan. Next up, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Anushka Shenoy, a physician in training in psychiatry at Oregon Health Sciences University and a leader of the newly established OHSU House Officers Union. We'll be discussing the punishing working conditions of physicians in training, how increased privatization and profit-making in the healthcare industry have made the medical encounter worse for both doctors and patients, and the ways that unions might help reverse some of those trends. Physicians in training are also known as house officers, interns, and residents or fellows, and you will hear Dr. Shenoy and I using all of those terms. Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg. And I'm going to be speaking today with Dr. Anushka Shenoy, who is a resident in psychiatry at the Oregon Health Sciences University. And she is also one of the leaders of the current drive to unionize physicians in training at the university. Anushka Shenoy, welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
When I heard that the house staff at OHSU was organizing, I was, of course, very interested because about 40 years ago in 1980, I was one of the leaders of an organizing drive at University of California, Davis, where I was in training to become a family physician. Back then, the big barrier to organizing was that we were considered legally to be students, not employees, even though we were working very long hours, very often without any kind of supervision, that is, we were working independently and we were getting paid for that work. Now, in 1999, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that residents in training were, in fact, employees, and that they had the right to collective bargain and actually even the right to strike. And I believe across the country now, the majority of the big teaching institutions, the physicians in training are organized. And at OHSU, the house staff is organized into a union, which you're calling the OHSU House Officers Union. And you've been bargaining with management, I believe, now for about 10 months. But before we get to that, Anushka, can you paint a picture for our listeners of what it's like to work as a house officer?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that background. And thank you for your advocacy work many years ago at UC Davis to help set the stage for all the work we're doing now. House officers, interns, residents, and fellows, we finished our medical degrees, and this is our first job as a new doctor. So we tend to be the first person you see when you enter a hospital. We are called interns and residents because historically we used to live and spend a lot of time in the hospital. So for me, for example, my first 2 years of training, my internship, which is my first year of training, and then my second year, I was in the hospital for most of my work. I would see patients in the emergency room. I would treat them on the medicine wards when they came in for something like pneumonia or heart failure. And I would also see patients in the acute psychiatry inpatient unit. In addition to doing that during the day, interns and residents do the vast majority of overnight and weekend call at the hospital. So on any given weekend, there's psychiatrists in-house admitting patients who need acute hospitalization. There's surgery interns and residents who are taking care of patients after they've had major surgery or triaging patients who might need surgery. There's family medicine interns and residents who are either on call for their clinics or taking care of patients in the hospital. As you proceed through training, your role can evolve and you can do more outpatient work. So, for example, if you came to see a psychiatrist at OHSU, it's very possible you would see someone like me, a resident, who's now in my fourth year of training, and I see patients on my own. And we are busy.
Tell us, how many hours roughly are you working, and how about taking breaks and that kind of thing?
Yeah, those are great questions. Again, it really varies by specialty. When I was working on the internal medicine wards, I would frequently get pretty close to 80 hours a week. We're legally not allowed to work more than 80 hours a week in the hospital. And surgery residents frequently hit that or unfortunately even work more hours than that. Now that I'm outpatient, it's a little bit less. On an average week, it's probably more like 50 to 60 hours. And then when I have weekend call, of course, that increases the hours. And in terms of working conditions, I think it's important to think about pre-COVID and post-COVID. But even pre-COVID, we don't clock in and out like a lot of people do. When we are on call, we are on call. We don't have scheduled lunch breaks or scheduled times to take other types of breaks, even to lie down or to rest if we're on for 24 hours at a time. So it's pretty grueling work.
Yeah, I think I did some quick calculations of what your hourly wage is if you're working 80 hours a week, and it comes to around, I think, $15 to $20 an hour, which is a little low considering the nature of the work you're doing. So I think that's a nice segue into talking about what have been your demands in your collective bargaining process. Kind of update us on where you're at in that process and what the sticking points have been?
So our main issues have been fair compensation for the work that we do and having a real seat at the table to improve conditions for our patients and ourselves. So regarding compensation, as you alluded to, we are paid much less than non-resident physicians. which we understand is part of the way that hospitals run and make money. But we do want a salary that increases faster than inflation and that increases in a transparent way. We also want to be able to have enough money beyond that salary to be able to live close enough to the hospital to get to work when we're needed. So we're asking for a housing stipend to help with that, understanding that we are compensated quite far below market and OHSU is in a part of town that's pretty expensive to live in. We also want some things that, you know, honestly, I think folks in other industries would find pretty basic. We want OHSU to pay for the medical license that we have to have in order to practice medicine, as well as the exams we need to take while we are residents in order to move forward in our training. All interns have to take step 3, which is the third in a line of exams that tests our medical knowledge. That test can cost up to $1,200. And currently we pay for that out of our own pocket while we're also dealing with the expenses of often moving to a new city, starting to pay our loans back, and on that about $15 an hour salary that can quickly get overwhelming. So, you know, we're really looking for OHSU to treat us with the same respect that they treat nurses and other types of workers who require licensure to do our job. And then the other part of it I wanted to tell you about is we are working to have a seat at the table to improve conditions. We are in the hospital a lot. We really have a on-the-ground view of how the hospital works. So we're advocating for things that we feel are missing to improve patient care. For example, making sure we have enough time off so that we can rest and be our best selves for our patients. We're also advocating for adequate funding to do our job, things like surgical equipment so surgeons can see the delicate vasculature they're working on, or even the right type of microphone so that I can do telepsychiatry from my home so my patients don't have to go into the hospital. So we're really advocating to make sure that we have what we need and perhaps more importantly, that the hospital and our patients have what they need.
A lot of what you're asking for would improve the lives of the house staff in very basic ways. I'm sure you know this, but our listeners may not, that suicide is the second leading cause of death among house officers, and that I have seen studies that suggest that up to a third of house staff struggle with symptoms of depression, and that the rates of divorce and substance abuse are very high among physicians in training, as well as high among physicians. And all of these, I believe, to be related to the kinds of time pressures and the enormous responsibility that house staff have to, and physicians have to work under. Does that accord with your experience?
Yes, absolutely. And as a psychiatrist, it's something I care deeply about. And I think it's interesting because the culture of physicians is, even while we were unionizing to advocate for ourselves, we were often thinking about our patients and figuring out how can the hospital be better. But I think there's this other really important part, which is that in order for us to take care of our patients, we do have to take care of ourselves. And even before COVID, all the statistics that you're alluding to are spot on. We have a higher risk of suicide, a higher risk of psychiatric conditions than peers in different industries. We're tired, we're burned out. And I think about it as on a personal level. You know, I've had two fairly urgent cesareans to deliver my two children. And I didn't want to have to think about whether my physician was rested or whether my anesthesiologist had a place to sit down close enough to the operating room so she could run in and be with me at a moment's notice. It's not good for me as a patient, and it's not good for me as a doctor. So I think a lot of the work we're doing is helping folks understand that we are people. We came into this line of work because we love it. And it takes a toll that it doesn't necessarily have to. And some of these basic things around having safe spaces, having enough money so we don't have to commute, you know, an hour into the hospital at 4 o'clock in the morning, those things really make a difference in our lives so we can help our patients.
I want to talk a little bit about the trends that I've observed over the past 4 decades or so in healthcare, and you've probably noticed some of this as well. There's been a huge trend toward privatization of hospital systems and pretty significant consolidation into large, usually hospital-based and fully integrated systems. And by that, I mean these big systems are in the business of delivering not just hospital care, but also primary care or specialty care or lab and radiology services, and sometimes their own nursing homes or even their own insurance programs. And one consequence of this is that over half of the practicing physicians now are employed, not owning their own practices and working independently, but are employed by these large private systems or by large government-sponsored systems like the VA. And over this period of time, the number of physicians grew by a factor of 1.5, while managers grew by a factor of 30. And so you see vastly increased administrative oversight of physician work and impingement on their clinical autonomy, unrelenting demands to see more patients and to assume more administrative tasks, and physicians and residents and interns are kind of have become profit centers for these large entities, corporate entities. How have these changes impacted or become apparent in your own unionizing drive or your own experience?
Yeah, those are really great questions. And the way that I think about it is that, you know, doctors are starting to realize, exactly like you said, medicine has been increasingly co-opted for a profit motivation. You know, I think doctors are taught to highly value expertise, right? Because we specialize to this insane degree. So for a long time, we've tended to think that we should leave hospital and healthcare administration to those who specialize in that. It's increasingly becoming clear that that is not in the best interests of our patients or for our own self-interest. Examples are what you talked about. You know, we don't get to choose as residents or often as employed physicians how many patients we see per hour. You know, family medicine doctors, I don't even know how many patients you see per hour, but even psychiatrists, the drive towards quote unquote productivity or seeing more patients in less time is incredibly demanding, because as bureaucracy and the complexity of the way medicine is paid for in this country has gone up, so has the administrative work that we need to do behind the scenes to adequately document the work that we do so that our employer can get paid for it. So I don't know the exact statistic on it, but I know that the amount of time that patients spend with doctors has gone down pretty dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years. And the percent of doctors' time that we spend behind a computer screen has gone up. So that's a huge burden.
Given all that, tell me why it is that more physicians don't unionize.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is that we are starting to organize, and we are actually, the OHSU is the last academic hospital on the West Coast to not have a resident union. So my first point is that this is starting to happen. It's slow. It's not as fast as other industries. I think there's a couple big reasons. One, doctors are incredibly busy, and it takes a lot of work to unionize, to educate a diverse group of people about how unionizing might be in your best interest. You know, I have surgery colleagues who were running around the hospital organizing people after working 80, 90, 100-hour weeks, and that is a lot to ask from anyone. Secondly, our jobs are very specific and very different from other people's jobs. So I think that it's taken some mutual education and collaboration between us and the large unions that represent other types of workers to figure out how best to meet our needs. I'll give you one example. All of our bargaining sessions have had to take place after 5 p.m. because you just can't get enough doctors free during the daytime to bargain. And then I think also this alludes to something we talked about earlier, where it's often difficult for doctors to internalize that their own health matters when it comes to taking care of patients. There is a very strong culture of these high achieving people who become doctors thinking that they should sort of just muscle through to focus on the good of the patient and not to look out for themselves. And changing that culture is really tough.
There is a culture that I remember and apparently is very persistent of, you know, be tough, don't be a whiner. just suck it up. Anushka, can you tell our listeners where they might find out additional information or follow your progress?
Yes. So I will start by directing you to the website, which is www.ohsuhou.org. That's where we have updates and all our most recent communications. You can also follow us on Instagram at OHSU_HOU, where sometimes the breaking news comes to Instagram first.
I want to wish you a lot of success in your current organizing drive. And thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me today.
Yes, thank you so much for your interest in this. And I hope everyone has a safe holiday season.
That was Dr. Anushka Shenoy talking about organizing efforts by the house staff at OHSU ongoing currently. And now we have a review by book mole Larry Bolden about the novel Puzzle Woman by Anna Ellery. In the novel, a mother attempts again and again to save herself and her two children from her abusive husband, running finally from West Germany to East Germany before the fall of the wall. She sends notes from the past to her children so they will know of her intense love for them. Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I am reading again today for Book Mole Larry Bolden. I want to talk to you briefly about a sprawling 500-page novel by Anne Ellery entitled The Puzzle Women. There are three narrative voices in the novel: Lotta, a young girl with Down syndrome, her older brother, Runa, whom she calls Rue, and the ghostly voice of their mother that comes to them only in words written long before. To give a rapid sketch of the novel without giving away too much, it moves back and forth between then, January 1989, and now, 1999, and from West Germany to East Germany, both before and after the fall of the wall. Mama has tried to escape with her children many times, running from her abusive husband, but he is a powerful person in the West German police, and he uses his influence each time to drag her back home. Finally, in desperation, she flees to East Germany to find an old friend who runs a home for battered women, and she takes with her documents of her husband's that she will use as bartering tools with the East German communist leaders to find safe passage for her and her children. Runa and Lotta are incredibly close, and Rue vows to care for her always. He, being older, remembers much of the abuse that his mother, and eventually he as well, has suffered from Papa. Lotta, only 5 when they make their escape, loves her Papa and believes him to be her protector. When a strange package appears in the mail with a notebook and many pages of drawings, Papa, in a rage, tears it all into tiny pieces and tells Lotta that it is all lies from her whore mother. Lotta manages to gather together all the pieces and tries to make sense of these words from Mama, whom she has been told is dead. When she reads of a group of women who are trying to reconstruct documents shredded in haste by the East German secret police as it became obvious that the wall would fall, she decides she has to find these puzzle women to help her reconstruct Mama's words meant for her and Runa. Saying, as her brother and her mother have always told her, that she is more than her Down syndrome and that she is independent, she sets off on her own to go to Nuremberg and the puzzle women. Turns out Lotta is incredibly good at putting together the fragments of her mother's pages, and several of the women take her under their wing and help her with the task. Sweet, kind Lotta is loved by most who meet her and look at more than just her medical condition. Slowly, the mother's voice emerges in wonderfully poetic strings of words meant for her beloved children. The more or less stream of consciousness words of Mama are often hard for this reader to follow and make sense of, but there is a wonderful poetic beauty to her words. Quote, Mama, Rue says, Lotta started, hair across her face and her cheeks pink from sleep. disheveled, more a baby when awoke from sleep than any other time. She's growing up so fast. The innocence of her wrapped around me and swelled in the room like a sunrise, expansive, hopeful. Her pajama bottoms scrunched up on one side, hair in a tangle. Moo bunny under her arm, the cold morning light at her back. But standing in front of me was the warmth of my child, fresh from sleep, a light within light, awoke from bliss to the world and into a world that has changed. End quote. Runa is a wonderful artist who begins his artistic career as a graffitiist, but who has great talent in portraiture and other forms of art. Hoping in 1999 to escape from his abusive father and take Lotta with him, he applies to an art institute that would provide housing as well as a stipend. Alas, his father manipulates behind the scenes and makes sure that his application for admission is rejected, in spite of the fact that teachers are very impressed with his portfolio. While this is primarily a novel about spousal abuse, there is much about the two Germanys both before and after the fall of the wall. Mama and her children do find refuge in the East, and the novel is quite fair regarding the good things about East Germany. But Runa is drafted into the pioneers and made to inform on his neighbors and even on the remarkable woman who runs the shelter. The poor boy carries with him tons of guilt over not having been able to save his mother, his inability to keep Lotta safe, and finally for the consequences of his informing on others. While this novel is difficult to read both emotionally and because of its form, I think it is a wonderful novel and recommend it to all serious readers. I don't think it lends itself to piecemeal reading. I have been talking about Anna Ellery's 2020 novel, The Puzzle Women. This is Patricia Kullberg reading today for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we're going to go back a little bit further in time. Sharon Grant, a community health educator for Multnomah County Health Department, reads to us from an article printed in the Middletown Press, Connecticut, published on June 21, 2020, titled Racial Unrest, Disease, and Depression, 1919 versus 2020. The article draws parallels to the social, political, and pandemic realities of today.
This is Sharon Grant, and I'm reading from the article Racial Unrest, Disease, Depression, 1919 versus 2020 by Jordan Fenster, from June 21st, 2020, Middletown Press. A global pandemic has begun to ease off, leaving many thousands dead and the economy in tatters, and civil unrest with racist underpinnings breaks out across the country. It was 1919. They called it the Red Summer. The parallels between the summer of 19 and the summer of 2020 are, according to Connecticut State historian Walt Woodward, quote, one of the situations where there is real resonance between the past and the present, end quote. The current coronavirus pandemic has been often compared to the influenza outbreak of 1918 and 1919, though there are some important distinctions. The death toll from the so-called Spanish flu, for example, so far outpaces the likely track of COVID-19. Likewise, there are some important distinctions, but also many parallels between the post-pandemic race riots, as they were called, of 1919 and the current ongoing protests against police brutality. There had been a series of white-led raids of Black communities, including a month of fighting in Connecticut, when in late July of 1919, a Black teenager was stoned to death while swimming in an area of Lake Michigan designated white only. Police refused to charge the attackers, and the violent clashes lasted for 2 weeks. Between January 1, 1919 and October of the same year, the Times tracked 38 race riots and clashes in cities and communities in various parts of the country. The flu pandemic, so-called Red Summer race riots of 1919 and World War I are integrally connected, as historian and author Kenneth C. Davis said. The Spanish flu spread so easily, he said, because the priority had been on winning the war. Soldiers contracted the flu and brought it back to military bases back home. In 1918, he said, scientists and doctors were ignored. In 1917, 1918, the priority was winning the war, and that meant keep pushing soldiers into the training camps, even though they were the breeding grounds for the disease, even though the doctor said, you have to slow this down. The first case in Connecticut of Spanish flu was identified at the naval base in New London in September 1918. By the end of the month, there were hundreds of identified cases, and from there, the virus spread west through the state. New London was also one of the early places where these riots broke out. The virus had started to abate in May 1919 when clashes between black and white sailors spilled onto the streets of New London. A fierce battle ensued on Bank Street that the town's entire police force and fire department could not stop, so authorities called in the Marines. Concurrent with the war and the flu, the United States was going through some cultural growth. The Great Migration brought as many as 450,000 black families from the South to work in urban areas up north. White soldiers returning from war found their jobs held by African Americans. White people, especially working class people and military men facing demobilization, they're the ones most threatened by this. At the same time, black soldiers who fought overseas were not prepared for the racism waiting for them back home. They had found a new sense of freedom over there. A lot of these soldiers came back and they weren't ready to accept second-class citizenship again. The summer of 1919 was called the Red Summer because of the blood, but also because of the threat of communism. Though white people largely instigated the 1919 riots, they were blamed on communists and anarchists who were supposedly inciting black community to violence, according to Cameron McWhirter. McWhirter, author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America, said he sees parallels to today. Propaganda at the time suggested that clearly the anarchists are circulating among African-American community and starting trouble. It set up that whole situation throughout the 20th century, McWhirter said. When people started accusing Antifa of causing all this violence, I definitely saw parallels. At the same time, there had been growing xenophobia and racism during and prior to the flu pandemic, according to Davis. In fact, Davis said black people were blamed for the flu in the early days of the pandemic. Then, as now, black communities were hit harder by the pandemic. Public health officials early on had blamed the great influx of African Americans into Chicago, the Northern migration. A sharp recession also hit the United States from early 1920 into 1921. It brought a collapse in prices and consumer demand so steep that it's considered a depression. It was not worse, said economist Fred V. Carstensen, an economic history expert, because the dangerous financialization of the economy, with its domino effects from credit collapses, had not happened yet, though it did in the 20s. There was a broad, informal social safety net among ethnic communities, he said. Households had little debt. Woodward said the two crises, the war and the pandemic, had a significant psychological effect on the nation. I think what happens between the flu and the war is America had this tremendous feeling of wanting to isolate and wanting to keep out the things that were dangerous, that were coming from somewhere else, he said. We always have, even today, we have a knack for blaming somebody for disease. Viruses, of course, know no race, no color, no creed, no nationality. They don't have passports. This is Sharon Grant, and I'm reading excerpts from the article Racial Unrest, Disease, Depression, 1919 versus 1920 by Jordan Fenster.
That's all for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Bill Resnick, Larry Bolden, and Fran Michelle for their help in putting the show together today. And a special thanks to our guests, Dr. Anushka Shenoy and Carla Frisch. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I have been your host this morning. A huge thanks to KBOO staffers who continue to make it possible for KBOO, your community radio station, to keep broadcasting during these challenging times. Later today, we'll post a downloadable podcast of today's show and its individual segments to the website at kboo.org. wishtheyouwere.fm. We will also post links to additional material that might interest you. You can contact the Old Mole at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with your questions and comments. Please join us again next Monday morning for more commentary from the point of view of the 99% and a vision of a radically democratic world. We're going to go out today with a song by the Drive-By Truckers, who are an alternative country southern rock band based in Athens, Georgia. In this song, they take on some of the heartache and anguish of being poor and homeless.
The parking lot behind Oasis Town, down the street from the Mexican restaurant behind the AutoZone, and the place that's hawking payday loans. There's a Kmart and a KFC, a fitness center and an Applebee's, Wells Fargo and a Taco John's, a good time bar to get your bad swerve on. In a town that's named for razor blades, all American but Chinese made, folks working hard for shrinking pay, 21st century USA.